You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year.
Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Recently, we looked at the history of the human brain in an evolutionary context. Our brains are the most metabolically expensive organs in our bodies. But what does that actually mean? How is metabolism actually defined? And what do we know about human metabolism through decades of science and millennia of evolution? My guest today, Herman Ponser, addresses these questions and many more, from his research on caloric intake and expenditures of hunter-gatherer peoples around the globe, to elite athletes and devotees of diets from keto to paleo to vegetarian and vegan. It's all pretty fascinating, and though many of us swear by our diet of choice, the amazing thing is that human metabolism is essentially conserved across nearly any diet or demography, even among the most active humans or the most sedentary. In his new book, Burn, How We Really Burn Calories, Lose Weight, and Stay Healthy, Ponser takes us on an interesting and surprisingly humorous tour of metabolism history and present, much of it based on his own research. Herman Ponser is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University and an associate research professor at Duke's Global Health Institute. Herman Ponser, author of the new book, Burn, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Herman Ponser, welcome to Medical Monday. Let's start by having you just try to define what metabolism actually means for us, because we all know the word, but what does it actually mean?
Yeah, so metabolism is all the work that all your cells do all the time. And so you've got 37 trillion cells in all your different organs and all the tissues and all throughout your body, and they all have work to do every second of the day. And all the work that they do takes energy. And so when we measure how much energy you're burning, how many calories you're burning every day, we're measuring the work that your cells are doing, and that's metabolism.
Right. And so there's this idea of basic metabolic rate. Define that for us. That's kind of the work we do when we're just kind of living. That's just the energy we burn just doing, being alive.
That's right. So your basal metabolic rate is that kind of background, when your car is in the parking lot, but the engine's on and you're just kind of idling there. That's the equivalent of your basal metabolic rate. It's just your engine kind of running in the background, doing all the housekeeping stuff to keep you alive.
One of the many things I liked about your book is that you debunk the kind of very common metaphor we use for caloric expenditure, which is, say, an engine or a machine. And you actually go many steps further and talk about caloric expenditure and metabolism as being a business. And I guess I was wondering if you could break that down for us. Why do we tend to think of it as an engine or a machine, and why is that wrong?
So, the engine view gets a few things right. And so I think that's why people like to use it so much. You know, we put fuel into our bodies in the form of food, and we do burn it off, in all the tasks that our body does, the way that an engine burns fuel. And so the engine approach, the engine metaphor is attractive, and it makes some sense. And it gets a few things right like that. But what it gets wrong is this. An engine, like the engine in your car, doesn't get to decide how it burns the fuel, right? It all has the way it burns the gas has everything to do with sort of how hard you step on the pedal. And your body isn't like that exactly. Your body is more like a business, like you mentioned. It has an overall job to do, an overall goal, like any business does. The overall goal of your body is to reproduce, to survive and reproduce, because we're products of evolution, and that's what every organism is evolved to do. But there's lots of parts and pieces and departments that are in the service of that overall goal, just like any big business, right? You've got HR and security and everything else, right? So it's the same as your body. You've got all these different organ systems that all work together. And like a business, when income is low, you can kind of juggle things around so you spend less on this task or less on that task. And when things are good, you can ramp up the energy that you spend on different tasks. And so that kind of juggling and prioritization that businesses do is the same kind of juggling and prioritization that your body can do with how it spends calories.
Yeah, and so carry that a little forward. So when times are tough, meaning essentially there's not a lot of food in the environment, which sounds almost comical in modern America, but you do a ton of research, or have done a ton of research, specifically, I think, in northern Tanzania with, I don't even know how to say it, Hadza? Is that how you say them?
Hadza? That's right, the Hadza tribe. Yep.
Okay, tell us about the Hadza tribe, because they're absolutely fascinating, and you've done a lot of work, and it sounds like you've made pretty good friends with many of them. It's interesting.
Oh, man, it's one of the most amazing communities of people I've ever had a chance to work with. The Hadza are the community of hunter-gatherer people in northern Tanzania, and, so by hunter-gatherers, we're saying they don't have any domesticated crops or domesticated animals, or machines or guns or electricity or anything like that. They live in grass houses, you know, in the open savanna in northern Tanzania. And every morning they wake up and women are off to get plant foods, berries and tubers. Men are off to hunt for wild game using bow and arrow. So, yeah, you know, they're very much aware of the outside world, but they have chosen to hold on to a very old traditions, which is to hunt and gather. And for somebody like me who studies how humans evolve, a community like that are just an invaluable way to kind of ask what hunting and gathering does to our bodies. Because, you know, humans were hunting and gathering species. Humans have been hunting and gathering for hundreds of thousands of years. And even before Homo sapiens showed up, you know, earlier species in our lineage were hunting and gathering too. So we're a hunting and gathering species. And to understand ourselves, we really get a lot out of working with hunting and gathering populations like the Hadza. And yeah, like you say, you know, in a population like that, food can be scarce sometimes, and you're always spending lots of energy on physical activity, so your body really has to be good at prioritizing how it spends its calories.
And so what are some examples of how our body systems, or as you point out in the metaphor, the business, divisions of the business can shut down if, you know, for example, food isn't plentiful? What are the things that go first? And this is different across, of course, species and in different animals or genuses, I suppose you could say.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So in a human, right, if all of a sudden income plummets, so all of a sudden you have no food available or you're starving, your body reacts by turning your metabolism down, by reducing how many calories you burn every day. Well, what does that mean? Well, the different tasks that your body does, like immune function, and you know, if you're a kid, it's growth, and if you're an adult, reproductive function, and other things that your body's doing throughout the day, it actually can reduce how much energy is being spent by those systems, and so you do less of them. So, you know, for example, if children don't get enough nutrition, if they experience a period of starvation, their bodies will stop growing. You know, certainly stop growing as fast during that period, and sometimes stop growing completely. If you're an adult, you'll see reproductive hormones, your estrogen levels or testosterone levels will decrease. You know, you can see immune function suffer when you're starving, and all of that is, you know, reflective of your body turning down the dial on all these activities to try to survive this starvation period.
Now, interestingly, mice, I think, is one example you cite where their priorities are a little bit different. So how does that work?
That's right. So a colleague of mine, John Speakman, his lab did this wonderful study looking at what happens when mice starve. You know, their priorities are different. So male mice, you know, their spleens get small. Your spleen is involved in immune function. So their immune systems are getting turned down. You know, all their different vital functions are getting turned down. All their organs actually shrink, except their brain and their testicles. So, you know, you can see the evolved prioritization in the mouse, right? You know, the mice, when times are tough, you know, you can turn everything off except reproduction and keeping your brain alive so you can survive.
Exactly. Well, tell us a little bit more about the Hadza. For example, they, as hunter-gatherers, they're not using cars. They're not jumping on motorcycles. I mean, they are walking everywhere they go. So as a population, as a group, these are people who are, in theory at least, burning a tremendous amount of calories. And yet, well, for one thing, they don't have obesity as a problem in their culture because they don't have the processed foods we have or frankly, the abundance of food. And yet, in spite of that fact, what you report in your science is that really their metabolism isn't all that different, even though they're burning so many more calories than the average American.
Well, so they're burning a lot more calories than the average American on activity. That's right. And so we went and about 10 years ago with two of my good colleagues, Brian Wood and Dave Reichland, we went and measured how many calories men and women in the Hadza community burn every day. And we use this really neat technique called doubly labeled water, which is, you know, it's the gold standard measurement for really measuring how many calories you burn every day. So we don't have to estimate it. We can really measure it carefully. And we expected, because they're so physically active, we expected that the total calories they burn every day would be so much higher than we see in the U.S. and Europe and other industrialized populations. And instead, what we found was that actually, even though, you know, men are getting 19,000 steps a day, women are getting like 13,000 steps a day on top of all the other work they do, even though they're that really, really active, they aren't burning more calories every day, total calories every day, than we are in the West. And instead, this is a surprise, physical activity ends up being another one of those things that the body can kind of juggle and adjust. And so in the same way that your body can adjust to changes in your food environment, your body can adjust to changes in your physical activity environment. And if you're more physically active, your body, your business, your metabolic business can turn energy down on other things and keep total energy expenditures the same, you know, in this really active population as they are in a really sedentary population.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Herman Pontzer, who's an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University, where he is also a research professor at Duke's Global Health Institute. His new book, which is really, really good and funny, I should add, is called Burn. New research blows the lid off how we really burn calories, lose weight, and stay healthy. And we're talking about Herman Pontzer's research with the Hadza peoples of northern Tanzania. And the Hadza are often cited. I mean, there are adherents of the so-called paleo diet. These are folks, these are our colleagues and our friends who, swear that when life was simpler, when we were hunter-gatherers, we ate a certain way and we didn't have problems with obesity or type 2 diabetes or high blood pressure. And so we want to try to emulate that nowadays. But what is it that the paleo folks get wrong? And in fact, the Hadza don't really avoid carbohydrates at all, do they?
Yeah, right. So, you know, if you go out and have a chance to live with a group like the Hadza, you know, all of a sudden the past goes from being a kind of cartoon, you know, to being real. And you realize that a lot of the stories we tell ourselves about the past, including things like the paleo diet narratives, are just kind of fall apart, you know? So there's this idea in the paleo diet world where, first of all, that there's one sort of single natural human diet, and that diet was very meat heavy, you know, hardly any carbs at all, and certainly no sugars. Well, you know, that's so obviously not true when you go out and live with a group like the Hadza. So, you know, the Hadza have a mix of plants and animals in their diet. It's about, if you look at where their calories come from, you know, it changes day to day and year to year, but about half of their calories are coming from plants and about half from animals. And not only that, but actually a large portion of their diet too comes from honey. And so something like 10 to 20% of their calories every day comes from wild honey, which is just sugar and water, you know, which it would not be on any paleo diet person menu. You know, that's forbidden stuff if you're on a strict paleo diet. But if you're Hadza, of course, actually living as hunter-gatherer, you eat it all the time. Now, another big part of their diet, the plant part of their diet, is these starchy tubers, and these root vegetables, which you often aren't allowed to eat on some version of the paleo diet. So so the idea that the paleo diet is, what, you know, the real ancestral diet that in which humans evolved would have been super meat-heavy, there's just no good evidence for that. But what's also funny is this idea that there is just one diet, you know, that there was just one way that we ate. It's kind of absurd to think about. If you look around globally today, think about all the different cultures, all the different diets, you know. When you go out and get takeout food, right, it's always, what kind of cuisine would you like? Chinese or Korean or Italian or Mexican, right? I mean, there's an enormous diversity of diets today. I don't know why we think that it was any different, you know, 100,000 years ago. People around the globe eat whatever's around. They eat differently depending on where they are. And so there is no one human diet. There never was.
Yeah, and I mean, that's definitely one of the big takeaways from your book is that, you know, humans have evolved, I guess, the way we have because of our opportunism. That is, we make do with what we have in the environment and we're able to take advantage of it and consume it and be omnivorous. And then the other thing, you know, that you taught me and kind of reiterated was this whole idea of how heat really probably fire, basically, the way it changes the chemistry of foods we eat really probably is what allowed our rapid brain growth and further development. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah. Isn't it fascinating? I mean, you know, you and I are here talking over an electric line, basically. I'm inside my house with the lights on and, you know, temperature controlled. And we use energy all day, every day in this modern world. And we don't even think about it. Like all the calories, basically, that our lives burn outside of our bodies, you know. And we think of that as kind of a very modern thing, all of this electricity and energy that we use and the gasoline in our cars and but actually, the external energy that we depend on, that gets its start back with fire, you know, which is 1.5 million years ago, human ancestors start using fire. And it's this kind of magical extra metabolism, this secondary engine that we get to tap into, and we can use it to change our food and make our food more energy dense. It kind of helps you process your food, digest your food outside your body by cooking it. We can use it to help keep ourselves warm so our bodies don't have to spend energy staying warm. We can use it to change landscapes and push animals around by burning, you know, brush fires and that kind of stuff to push animals around. We know that you know, hunter-gatherer groups do that all the time. And so, you know, it really starts there, this kind of dependence on external energy. And then, you know, fast forward to today, and we've got that same kind of dependence just ramped up to 1,000. And we're using fossil fuels to do it, which creates all these climate problems. But kind of disentangling that from the fact that we've actually evolved to depend on this external energy, that gets really tricky, right? Because the food we eat, the way we move around. These are all the ways that we've been using external energy to kind of help ourselves for millennia. And figuring out how to do that in a way that doesn't harm the planet is kind of the next big challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And that's sort of where you kind of end the book. But let's talk a little bit more about food, because there's some really interesting ideas that you propagate in here about caloric intake. And I guess we can look at, there's a couple of examples that you take from sort of, you know, I would say popular press or popular culture. For one was The Biggest Loser. And this is a TV show that I didn't really watch. I wasn't that familiar with it. But these are folks who are kind of incentivized on a television program to lose a ton of weight. And there's a much longer story, of course, than just the TV show itself. Now, these people, I don't know if all of them, but many of them did lose a significant, like 100 pounds in many cases.
Oh, yeah.
But what's the kind of longer version of that story?
Yeah, well, you know, it's the story of that metabolic adjustment and your the business of your metabolism making adjustments in ways that are kind of predictable but frustrating. So these folks, you know, they went on this show and it's just a really brutal routine that they're put under. They are starved and they are made to work out these ridiculous amounts of exercise. And, you know, their bodies, you lose energy, you lose weight that way. In fact, you lose a lot of weight that way, but it's not sustainable at all. You know, your body is pushing back hard. So the metabolic rates crash, you know, really go down because their body's trying to figure out how to fix this starvation that they're experiencing. And even 6 years later, when they're in these long follow-up studies that have been done, the folks that have been able to keep the weight off, their metabolisms are still depressed because their bodies are still sort of responding to that starvation mode that they went through. And not only that, but a lot of them gain the weight back. So it just goes to show you how hard it is, you know, the way to fix, you know, the obesity crisis, both societally but also for ourselves individually, is not some big drastic crash, you know, approach. You've got to go more sustainably than that because the body will just push back if you push too hard.
Yeah, and so that really gets to kind of the other huge fundamental takeaway from your book, which, you know, this is the phrase that you and the scientific community have come up with, which is constrained daily energy expenditure. That's what's really interesting here.
Yeah. So this is, you know, back to the HADSA study. No matter how active, even though the HADSA were really, really physically active, they're not burning any more calories than people who are more sedentary. Why is that? Well, you know, their metabolic business has adjusted, and so they spend less on other stuff to make room for that big physical activity workload that they have. Well, we'll see the same thing across species, for one thing. We see this is true in mice and other primate species that, you know, you can get groups that are more active and groups that are less active and they have the same expenditure. So this is a widespread phenomenon in all mammals and in all birds too. But actually also within a human population, if we take, you know, if you or I start an exercise program tomorrow, well, we'll burn extra calories for that exercise for a while, but after a couple months, our bodies will adjust so that we're spending about the same energy, you know, every day as we were before we started the exercise. So your body is trying to adjust. And this is true for humans and other species too, but your body is trying to adjust how it spends its energy to keep the total calories burned every day within a relatively narrow range. And that's just, it just speaks to how kind of adaptable and flexible our bodies are and how we're not really in charge of our metabolisms the way we think.
And we're talking about this really key concept, which is constrained daily energy expenditure. Which is, when you think about it, I guess, or the way I think that we theorize about it, is that it makes sense because it's that adaptability for times of scarcity that our bodies, it's like that business. It's like that business analogy, really not like an engine. Because I think that, you know, one fallacy with that whole engine model is we think, okay, I've got to spend more burn more calories than I take in. So that means I either have to eat less or exercise more or both. And I guess on The Biggest Loser, that's what was done. They starve themselves and exercise more. But as you point out, the metabolism adjusts and it becomes harder and harder to lose weight. And so one of the other big take-homes, which was kind of surprising, and I think, you know, I've seen you in the press and other places on this, and there's a certain, amongst your colleagues anyway, like a fatalism that says, oh, well, exercise really doesn't matter. But it's not that at all. You are very careful to say that even though exercise isn't really a great weight loss strategy, that it's very important for your overall health. And I guess I was wondering if you could sort of tease that apart a little bit.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right, and thank you for bringing that up. This is a really exciting area of research right now for me and my colleagues. So, as you said, if you're more physically active, You don't burn more calories a day that way necessarily, but instead you change the way your calories are spent. So rather than changing the total calories you burn every day, the bigger effect of exercise is it changes the way you spend your calories. And if you spend your calories on exercise, right, what that means is you're spending less calories on other tasks. And for most of us, that's a really good thing, because if we spend less energy, for example, on inflammation, right, we reduce our inflammation levels. If we spend less energy in stress reactivity, so, you know, our cortisol levels don't go up as high and our adrenaline levels don't go up as high when we get stressed out, which happens, you know, throughout the day. And it seems that exercise might also help keep, testosterone for men or estrogen levels for women at a slightly at healthier levels, slightly reduced from the really high levels we see in a lot of men and women in the U.S. So that adjustment, that metabolic adjustment that we make, is one of the reasons exercise is so, so good for us. And so rather than the punchline being, oh, therefore, you know, if your body adjusts to exercise, you don't have to do it. That's not the punchline at all. It's because your body adjusts to exercise, that's why you better do it, because those adjustments are what one of the reasons that it's so good for you.
And so you are definitely not writing this book as a weight loss guide, because in fact,
no.
If anything, you are trying to pierce the thought balloons of many of these diets. And you're kind of, one of your points is like these diets, you know, in the long run, they never really work. The best diet is the diet you can stick to. And so you're not advocating really one kind of eating over another, and in fact acknowledging through evolution that, as we talked about before, that we're basically omnivores. But one of the interesting things I did take out of the book is if you do want to lose weight, you're probably for your thought, your expenditure of calories on thinking about it, you're probably much better off adjusting your diet and taking in fewer calories or higher quality calories. That's nutrient-dense food with more fiber, that type of a thing. But what was really interesting was you can lose weight just on the nutrition side, but in order to maintain the weight loss, that was where the exercise really was important.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, let's rethink what exercise is doing, right? Rather than worrying about exercise as adding calories to our total expenditure, think about the way that exercise is changing the way your body works. It's like, I call it the rhythm section, right, of your body, right? It's kind of keeping everything on the same page, on the same beat. And it helps regulate how your body works. And so once you get to that healthier weight, once you are able to lose weight and get to that where you want to be, exercise is really key in keeping yourself there. So it does seem to be really important in weight maintenance. And that's because it's not so much the calories again, but it's changing the way that your body regulates how hungry you feel, how full you feel, and all that stuff. So absolutely, it's another good reason to exercise.
Okay, and so as long as we're talking about exercise and nutrition, we have to talk about these elite athletes, because you have a whole chapter on that. And the guy who haunted your dreams, I guess, was Michael Phelps, the famous multi-gold medal swimmer for the USA.
Yeah.
And supposedly Michael Phelps once boasted, or somebody about him boasted, he eats 12,000 calories a day, I think that was the number. But you kind of try to take that myth a little bit apart and show how even a guy who burns as many calories as Michael Phelps and eats as much as he does, even though he's elite, and you admit he's elite, but he's not really outside the realm of humanity.
Yeah, this is the Michael Phelps question. I haunted my dreams is not too not too extreme a way to put it. That's exactly right. Every time I would, I'd have a chance to go and tell people about these cool data that showed how total energy expenditure seemed to be constrained and your body works to keep it in a certain level. Somebody would always ask, well, what about Michael Phelps? And it's a great question, because it is clear that at least for short periods of time, you can do more than you can burn, 7 or 8 or maybe even 10,000 calories for a while. And obviously, if energy expenditure is really constrained within some narrow range, then that level would be way higher than whatever we think the normal range would be. And so we had a chance to look into this into some detail. We had people who ran from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C., a marathon a day every day for 5 months or something like that. So we had their measurements for their total energy expenditures. We had people who ran who raced in the Tour de France. Their energy expenditures had been worked on and published before. And, of course, we had people who had done, like, triathlons and ultra states, 100-mile marathons. And we had pregnancy, which turns out to be a very expensive and long-lasting event. And so we were able to look at this and take all the highest expenditures for the longest amount of time that we could find, and we could kind of plot out this metabolic ceiling that is the limits of human metabolism. And it's kind of a sloping ceiling. So If you only are going for a day, you can burn 10,000 calories or so. If you're going to try to do it for a month, like they do in the Tour de France, well, then the cap there is about 7,000 or 8,000 calories a day. And if you're going to go for 5 months, like the people who we measured who ran from L.A. to D.C., well, they were able to keep up sort of 4,000 to 5,000 calories, maybe even close to 6,000 calories a day. Right? So you can see that as the event gets longer and longer and longer, the amount that your body's able to burn, right, the maximum amount that you can burn goes down, down, down. And eventually, at really long time horizons, like over years, then that metabolic ceiling is where we all live under, which keeps us all around, 3,000 calories a day or so. And so that metabolic ceiling, that limits, that ceiling to what we can do, you ask, well, where does Michael Phelps fit into that? Well, Michael Phelps, first of all, the 12,000 calories thing turns out to be a bluff. He wasn't actually doing 12,000 calories, but he probably was burning, as far as we can tell, around 7,000 or 8,000 calories a day during peak training. Okay, and so that makes sense because that means that for a couple months, he's able to do this high-intensity peak training block of work to get ready for the Olympics or a big competition. And then after that, he has to have a rest season. And so we know this about elite athletes, right, for the Tour de France cyclists, anybody else. You can push, and then you have to relax and rest. And that's because long-term, we all live under the same ceiling, even the superhumans like Michael Phelps.
Okay, and you mentioned it there, but I think the last question is just how important pregnancy is or physiologic state it is. And I guess if you could just make that comparison, I thought that was incredible.
Yeah, so, you can push the body, like I said, in the Tour de France, you can push it to like 7,000 or 8,000 calories for a month. If you're going to run a marathon a day across the U.S., I think that's about 5,000 or 6,000 calories a day. And then at 9 months, what's the most amount of calories you can spend over a 9-month time frame is pregnancy. And that is, it's amazing, but also kind of makes sense that pregnancy is pushing the same metabolic limits as something like the Tour de France, right? It's your body's metabolic machinery at full blast for as long as it can keep it up. And that's, in pregnancy as well as in these more sort of obvious athletic competitions. And it just speaks to how taxing pregnancy is, for one thing, but it also speaks to how these things are all connected, right? Our abilities to do these high performance activities, well, maybe, maybe the machinery for that is actually evolved through selection to, be able to produce big babies, because we know that humans have bigger babies than other apes do. So the sort of energetic machinery kind of gets co-opted into these different tasks. It makes these funny connections that kind of unite all of this different experience that we live our lives through.
Well, this is a fabulous book. I learned a ton, and I really enjoyed reading it. I kind of couldn't put it down. The name of the book is Burn. New research blows the lid off how we really burn calories, lose weight, and stay healthy. And it's by my guest today, Herman Ponser, who is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. Herman Ponser, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it was a really fun conversation. Thanks for having me on.
Herman Ponser is an associate professor of evolutionary anthropology at Duke University. His new book is Burn. New research blows the lid off how we really burn calories, lose weight, and stay healthy. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening. Please stay safe out there and get those vaccines the first opportunity you get.